Hi, I'm Dr. Kirsten Lauritsen. I'm a personal functional medicine practitioner for high performers and professional athletes. And I've worked with athletes in many different sports, from the U.S. sailing team to endurance sports and triathlon, CrossFit, and professional tennis players across the board in any sport. Maintaining a foundation of a healthy body and mind is crucial for long-term success. This is the podcast that will show you how to apply the principles of a healthy body and mindset to achieve high performance, all from the inside out. This is the Fit and Healthy Athlete Podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Fit and Healthy Athlete Show. Today, I have a guest with me today. Dr. Melissa McDonald is a graduate of Northwestern Health Sciences University, where she earned her Doctor of Chiropractic, a fellow chiropractor. She then spent 2 years of specialty training in the Human Performance Center, where she focused her research and clinical skills on specific testing and treatment protocols. And this is really important because today we're going to talk a lot about knee injuries and different types of injuries that especially female athletes have a tendency to get and why that is. Additionally, Dr. Mack is the team chiropractor for MN Roller Derby, River City Rhythms, a Drum Corps International, which is really cool, and also the MN Vixen, a professional women's football team. So Dr. Mack has achieved both international and national certifications as a chiropractic sport provider. She's a faculty member at Northwestern Health Sciences University, where she teaches emergency procedures, and she's also a speaker on sports chiropractic issues in health and wellness in the United States, as well as abroad. So now she also hosts, this is going to be good too, because you'll have to pop over to her podcast as well, because we're going to do an episode with me too at the MAC Performance Podcast, the health and wellness podcast that will whiplash you into health. So Melissa, Dr. Melissa, welcome.
Hi, I'm excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. Oh my goodness. Let's just start off with, like, we've heard your bio, but give us a little details. Who are you? How'd you get into chiropractic? How did you get into doing what you do? Let's just start there.
Absolutely. So I grew up knowing I wanted to be in the medical field. I just didn't know where. And initially I wanted to be a surgeon because we all grew up watching Grey's Anatomy and like, oh my God, I want to find my Mr. McDreamy. I want to be a surgeon. Then I shadowed actual surgeons and I was like, ew, this is not the same thing. And I really struggled with finding my path because I was like, I want to take care of the whole person. And surgery, you have to almost dehumanize them because you have to be able to cut them open. And I was like, I don't like that.
Yeah.
So I started searching. My mother, who is actually a physical therapist, went, you know what? Why don't you look into chiropractic? And I was like, I found that really interesting now looking back on it. Why was my mother, who's a physical therapist, telling me to go into chiropractic? But it was the autonomy that a chiropractor has. It's the ability to be independent, not have to require referrals, and be able to take care of the person as a whole without having necessarily medical oversight. Because at the time she practiced, the MDs would like, hey, this is the path, this is the what you are going to do. And she's like, you'd hate that. You need to be able to do your own thing. And I was like, awesome. So I started looking at it, settled on Northwestern, and started my chiropractic journey. Now, I didn't get into sports until towards the end of my chiropractic path. I initially wanted to be a radiologist. Then again, realized, oh, I don't like not having the answer of what happens after I read and give a horrible thing. And was like, no, this isn't me. And then someone was like, hey, why don't you come shadow me on a sideline? And I was like, oh, I've never done that. That sounds fun. And oh my God, the adrenaline. Mm-hmm. My first ever sideline, an athlete dislocated and spiral fractured their humerus. And I was like, I don't know what to do. This is horrible. Mm-hmm. I want to do it more. And I became an EMT. And that just started my journey that is now 6 years long of sidelines every week, working with athletes and figuring out how do I prevent those bad things from happening so that I don't have to deal with them. Because I want to go watch sports. I don't want to have to work at a game.
Sure, sure. And it's so interesting too, because when you really start to look at it, there's a lot of injuries that athletes get that are actually really preventable from like many different ways of looking at it. Like whether you're looking at mobility and, you know, PT and all of those types of things to then, and movement patterns to then like strength, which kind of gets incorporated in that, to then like inflammation and nutrition and a lot of those types of things as well. So it's really, I love that. I love that journey that you got in, how you got into sports and chiropractic and all of that. So were you, I'm just curious, were you into sports when you grew up at all?
I did. So I was a competitive swimmer when I was younger. I grew up in Florida. Yes. So I competitively swam from 7 to 13. And then my parents were like, ew, Florida's getting a little rough. We want to raise our children where we have four seasons. They moved us to the middle of nowhere, Michigan, and there wasn't any swimming. So then I switched to volleyball and then participating in track because I am not a runner. I threw things. That was my thing.
Okay.
So I threw things really far. And then in college, I actually did some Scottish Highland dancing.
Oh, how fun. How fun. Oh my gosh. So many interesting things, so many different things.
I mean, it's all going to scream a little ADHD, which I fully admit to having, because I was like, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. Now I'm into weightlifting and powerlifting. Yes. And that has really been my happy place is cool. Lifting heavy things and putting it back down again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a surprising thing that I got into in my 20s that I didn't realize was something that I really enjoyed. It was just like the ability to push past, like if you'd been stuck right at a weight for a certain amount of time and then finally breaking past that and knowing that you like not only got stronger, but you can potentially, you know, lift up bags of dog food and you can, oh my gosh. Okay. Crazy story. Before we get into like all of the things, one caveat story. So there was a time when I was helping unload like a vehicle or a van or a bus or something. And I picked up a, you know, one of those Costco, like water, like all the water bottles in there, they're pretty heavy and they're kind of awkward. I just lifted the thing up and put it on my shoulder. And I remember some dude being like, are you sure you should be doing that? Like, that seems really heavy. And I just kind of looked at him and I was like, you know, I appreciate the concern, but this is also like, this is very light for me based on like all of the things that I do. And I actually train so that I can do stuff like this. And I was like, it's okay. It's okay. But let's maybe have a learning lesson here that it's okay. People can lift heavy things, especially women. And it's actually really good for us.
My favorite thing in the gym is lifting with my husband.
Yeah.
And us not having to change the weights.
So good.
And people looking and going, wait, what? What? Ooh. But I mean, like, I didn't get access. And I think this really lends into the topic we're going to talk about is the fact that when I was in high school, so I graduated in 2006.
Okay.
We weren't allowed in the weight room. That was for the football players. That was for the baseball players. The women, the girls, we weren't allowed to go in there because that was for the boys, which means I didn't really even have access to a gym until after college because I wasn't a collegiate athlete. I didn't have access to someone teaching me. I didn't know. The gym's intimidating when you don't know how to utilize it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't something I had access to. And that's a problem.
It is. It is. So I have a feeling we're going to loop back into this. Let's start off with just kind of our beginning topic, I would say, of this episode. So first, what I wanted to dive into a little bit is, per our conversation previously, is particular injuries specifically for female athletes that we have a tendency to be a little bit more prone to. What do those potentially look like? And then we'll dive into those bits and pieces after that.
Yeah. And so there's two main ones that just on a statistical scientific average, women sustain more often than men when it comes to activities across the board. So one of those is concussions. And so when looking at like ice hockey, when looking at basketball, when looking at soccer, which are pretty comparable. I mean, women's hockey is non-contact.
Sure.
Hear the disgust, understand the disgust. It's non-contact. So because of that, you would expect there to be fewer head injuries, and yet when looking at NCAA Division I, women are 2 to 3 times more likely to have concussion compared to men. And then for ACL, it is astronomically 5 to 6 times more likely in soccer and basketball for those non-contact knee injuries for an ACL rupture to happen. There is one sport, though, that men and women have equal risk for ACL injury, and that's downhill skiing, which is really interesting. And I think it's something that we need to take a closer look at as to why that is. In my own like research mindset, is why is that sport where we equal, but other sports we can't get that equatable? And I have theories.
Great. Do you want to dive into the theories now?
Yeah,
Why
we
don't we
can
do
dive into
that?
that.
Let's do that.
So
Because I'm curious.
one of the reasons I think is because for downhill skiing, the training is identical.
Yeah,
They
totally.
train identically, they weight train identically, everything is the same and everything is equatable. Therefore, the injuries are the same. But yet when we look at other sports, there is a definitive difference. I mean, and people will be like, no, it's getting better, Title IX. Okay, let's just think back to the NCAA championship gyms that they provided the men's teams versus the women's teams last year, and recognize the fact that okay, some yoga mats and dumbbells do not equate to comprehensive lifting racks. And until social media went, oh, that's not right, and a company then donated the equipment to the women's, they finally were able to have the same equipment as, or at least similar equipment to the men. Because, oh, women don't need to lift heavy. Hi, what is the best reason we prevent ACL and ligament injuries? Weight training.
Well, I really love this topic too. So because before I start getting into like rabbit holes, the reason why I really like this topic is because a lot of so I do a lot of triathlon now. I was doing a lot of, well, I still kind of do, but I was doing a lot of CrossFit. Now I'm focusing a lot on triathlon and into like the endurance world and endurance sports. And the one thing that I've seen between the two that is drastically different is that the strength training programs that I've seen a lot of all have their merits for sure, as far as like building a little bit more of those, strength in positions, like you're constantly on one leg when you run and, bits and pieces that go into that. But they have a tendency not to have this whole idea of like lifting really heavy. And I do think that that does play into why we see particular injuries for female athletes, especially in endurance sports. And so what are some of the things that really go into this idea of like lifting heavy and how it relates to those knee injuries? What are some of the things, like some things that have been discussed? I'll just sort of preload the question, like the QL angle, where for viewers, listeners, that's basically how the wide or narrow the hips can be, and then that angle leads to the knees and pressure on the knees. You want to dive into that a little bit? Let's get into like the nitty-gritty of some of those things.
Oh, yeah. So there has been countless amount of research trying to figure out why ACLs are more prevalent in women's sports. And again, there has been discussions on QL angle. So again, hip to knee angle, how wide the hips are, as you said, the size of the actual ACL, the size of the connection point into the tibia. There has been discussions of the hormones. So with menstrual cycling, how the hormones influence our ligaments, because this is something that isn't overly taught or discussed within the medical realm, that we're more than just a bikini.
Yeah.
It affects more than just our breasts and our uterus. It does actually systemically affect every aspect of our body. And then the other aspect of is just the frank strength of like the hamstring, which also prevents anterior, so frontwards translation of our tibia, which is what the ACL prevents. So it's a secondary safety mechanism, is having a strong hamstring.
Right, right.
So where do we go with, and here's my problem with this, is we've looked at all these things that are definitively different between men and women, but yet one thing we haven't looked at, and this is actually a research question that I'm working with some students to get answered potentially, is when we know strength training and heavy strength training is the key to preventing injuries in men's sports, when do women get access to it? When are women actually working with a certified strength and conditioning coach? When are they actually being put into a true heavy lifting with Olympic lifting? When are we getting access to that? And I would say for our late 20s, early 30s athletes, they may are just getting their toes wet into that realm, listening to the fact that, oh yeah, you're not going to come out looking like She-Hulk unless you want to look like She-Hulk, mm-hmm. at which point you're going to be eating so much protein and using performance enhancing hormones to achieve that, that lifting is really about creating a stressor that forces change. Our body is a brilliant system that responds to outside forces to create something that's stronger. So one, lifting heavy is actually really beneficial in preventing osteoporosis, in preventing stress fractures. Why? Because it forces the little cells that build up the bone to do their job, because they go, oh, look, we're under stress. We have to build more. Right. Same things goes into the ligaments and the tendons. They don't heal well because they don't have blood flow. But if they're put under pressure, the body goes, oh God, I need to strengthen these things, and forces them to be strengthened. So will a singular lifting program prevent all injuries? No. Will it reduce injury likelihood of a non-contact problem? Yes. When combined with other training modalities such as plyometrics and landing exercise, those type of activities, you mix them together as you would with a men's team, and magically women's teams respond well too. So are all the differences that make us with the hormones, with the QL angles, do those influence us? I don't know, because we haven't done the important study of, if we just put them in a squat rack, will it get better?
Yeah.
Rant. Right. Sorry.
No, you're good. No, you're totally fine. So, and that's the thing. And that's actually the question that I had when you brought up the case study of looking at downhill skiers, if it really is just injury prevention has a lot in female athletes, particularly, just has a lot to do with the differences in the way that we're trained. And I would also wonder if that comes down to when we get introduced to it as well, because as you mentioned, like for us, especially, so you graduated in 2006, I graduated in 2008. So very similar in time frame. And I remember playing volleyball, and like my sister and her friend, because they were potentially going to go play in college, they got introduced to weightlifting probably also because they had an interest in it. But then I don't remember ever really being, you know, kind of drawn into that by any means. And I think that's a very interesting thing to think about, you know, and then that led to my sister getting into CrossFit and then her doing her whole jaunt with that. But I don't ever, I like, I just remember, you know, we would go run a mile. Like that was our preparation for our season. And that was like really about it. It was like kind of stay fit-ish. And that was really all we got access to. But then the injuries that like plagued all of us on the volleyball team. I mean, it was all of it, right? It was shoulder stuff. It was knee stuff. Like, I had the worst posterior tibialis pain you've ever experienced. It was so bad. And I was told to just have orthotics, which is like, again, this is this like really terrible way of looking at like what is going on with the body and just being like, let's just put a brace on it and call it good. It's like, yep. Like, honestly, it's the worst. It is the worst physical medicine.
But this is the issue is the fact that one, research within women's health didn't really start until the 90s. Yeah. Because we, with our hormones, were determined to influence the research too much and make things not work out.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. We were too complicated. Mm-hmm. And therefore, a man, 120-pound man, was equivocable, which is why, like, oh, fun fact, if you weigh over 150 pounds, hormonal birth control may not prevent pregnancy. But they don't make that easily known. So no. I'm sorry to your listeners if you just started screaming at your speaker, because these are the things that are problematic within the healthcare system, is it is a very man-centric thought process, because our hormones make us too complicated to do the research on, and then they go, and there's no money. That's the other thing. Women's sports don't have the financial backing because it's too slow, it's too boring, people aren't interested. But yet, if a athlete performs too well in women's, they then are questioned on whether they are actually a woman, and then new rules are made to ban them because we can't perform at a high enough level. Yet you look at Michael Phelps, who has a known genetic predisposition to producing less lactic acid, meaning he doesn't get sore, his muscles don't fatigue, and therefore leads him to being able to win multiple gold medals. But that's fine, that's fair.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I we could probably go on this for hours.
We're about to get way off topic, but yes, yeah. Knee injuries.
But yes, no, but it's all part of the conversation though, right? Like, creating these conversations, creating the space for these conversations is a very, very important thing, because it's part of what hopefully will produce change and move us forward. And that's the whole entire reason for, first off, why I do what I do, and then also why I have this podcast, is because I hope that by educating athletes and by educating people, that we can move people forward, we can move athletics forward, we can move and make change in this industry, because it's just been too long that athletes in particular, but people in general, women in general, have just not received the amount of appropriate care. And this goes for actually men and women in really this case, but like, healthcare in general for athletes has suffered. It has not been the best that it could be for people who are trying to achieve incredible things. So that's the whole reason why I do what I do, but also why we're here, is because I really want to move these conversations forward and try and see if we can generate some change in this industry. So ACLs, those are a couple of things, and it's actually really common. If you start kind of looking around and watching athletes, and particularly female athletes, you'll see a lot of ACL tears. I do think that's interesting, and this is actually just a personal question. You mentioned hamstring strength as a piece of what contributes to that, but it's actually common for us to see more quad dominance, particularly in females. Can you shed light on that a little bit, about like what I'm talking about there, and then also how that can lead to imbalances?
Oh, absolutely. So let's start off with quad dominance in women. It is a common issue. It has to do with the mechanics of how, again, the QL angle puts us at an angle, and then the shape of our hips and the fat deposition, AKA why we have curves, creates a weight distribution that puts our quads in a dominant state. On top of that, because of where we carry our weight with our chest and our hips, it just, our body mechanics, it turns the quads on more.
Sure.
When we have a quad dominance, this actually puts a greater pull on our patellar tendon. This is why, especially in younger women and girls sports, you have a higher incidence of something called Osgood-Schlatter's.
I have that.
Which is actually where the point on the front of the tibia gets pulled and actually creates a bump. It's extraordinarily painful, mm-hmm. and very common in our soccer and running athletes within girls sports.
I literally got it in fourth grade playing soccer.
I'm sorry, you're a statistic.
I know, I'm a case in point.
Sorry,
keep going.
No. And then the other thing is that quads are really seen as kind of a glamour muscle when it comes to what we're lifting. So like squats, lunges, all of those are really going to emphasize our quads. And for a lot of our programming, they're a huge emphasis within the weight training, because weight training is based around men's athletes and they are not quad dominant. So all the programs are built around that without having the greater emphasis on hamstrings. But so within soccer, this is where the most amount of money goes. They have a lot of ACL injuries. They have a lot of hamstring strains. So they have put a lot of money into prevention programs, and they have realized that when we have a quad dominance, so when we do actual muscle testing and we put a handheld dynamometer and we go, what is the strength of your quad compared to your hamstring? When it's not 1-to-1, you're at an increased risk for a hamstring strain or an ACL injury. And 1-to-1 is a huge number, because very few women are walking around athletically with having those muscles balanced.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things we do preseason is we do handheld dynamometry with my football team and actually figure out what is our quad to hamstring ratio, and then program their off-season injury reduction programs to include big exercises like our two favorites, the RDL, so straight leg deadlift, and our Nordic hamstrings. Nordic hamstrings has one of the highest efficacies for prevention of hamstring injuries, which inherently will help protect the ACL. So those are probably our two favorite things we like to program and really work on actually getting control all the way to the ground, all the way back up. Which, when you think about it, if you've ever done a Nordic hamstring, oh, that's mean. Yeah. That's big mean. But then we also like to add a glute ratio in there. So it's 1-to-1 quad to hamstring, and then a 0.7 to one glute. So we want that glute almost as strong as our hamstrings and quads. So those are going to be the three muscles we're focusing on in creating a balance to get our knees protected. But then we're also looking at how the athlete moves. Now, could we look at a squat and go, you're at a risk for an ACL injury? No, there is no research indicating that that is a method of being predictive of injury. What's interesting is they're starting to look at, it's not necessarily a singular squat, but if you had a person do 100 squats, which athletes squat number one and squat 100 looks the same versus which athlete fatigues and their squat decompensates, the decompensating athlete potentially has a higher risk of injury. Now, are we going to have you do 100 squats in a session just to be like, could you be at injury risk? No, that's where we go back to that muscle testing and go, we have a ratio that's not working together. Let's try to shore this up to prevent. And then also working on explosive loading. So jumping, landing, going up and over boxes to actually create some different movements to really create a space that the knee moves safely.
Right. So, there's a lot in there, but that is like really helpful. There's a ton of takeaways there that are really, really critical. And a piece of that too is like, it's all based on research. It's based on science and ways that you can build a strength training program out of research that's actually been done on female athletes, which is not, there's not that much of it, but there is some, and we can base it off of some of that, right?
Yeah. I want to say I think it's FIFA 11 plus. I think that's right. It might be a different number. It might be FIFA 12 at this point, but a FIFA 11 plus is a custom. It is created as a warm-up because they're recognizing if we want to actually have injury reduction, it has to be the warm-up the athlete does. Yes. Because if they actually incorporate it into their warm-up, then one, we actually know they're doing it.
Yes.
Two, so FIFA created this warm-up and went, this is the warm-up that's going to prevent hamstring and knee injuries.
Okay.
Now, is it geared towards soccer? Is it specific to it? Yes. Is it a base that you could then incorporate into other sports? Yes.
Yeah.
So that's where here is a already made program that you can take and then modify it based on the activity or have someone modify it for your group for that activity. So the FIFA 11 plus is the best hamstring and knee injury prevention warm-up program by the literature out there.
So good. Okay. I also now have another question, let's dive a little bit deeper. ACL tears. There has been some suggestion that it may have something to do with the menstrual cycle as far as when we often see those tears. Have you seen anything in that realm? And do you have any insight on that, of what you think anyway?
I actually have seen some things with working with a professional women's football team. Mm-hmm. You now add contact, hardcore, full hitting, full kit football. And I will say so you watch the NFL, you watch the NCAA, and you might hear of like 5 or 6 ACLs in a season across the league.
Sure.
I will see 6 to 8 ACLs on my team. Mm-hmm. It is insane. You add contact to a women's sports. And I will say there was one season where I was given free rein to do the preseason injury prevention I wanted. And we reduced it, but then they took away my funding.
Oh no.
So, rant, that's a side point, but hormones. So we have our estrogen. So when you actually start your menstrual cycle up until ovulation, you're in an estrogen phase. Then at ovulation, you switch to progesterone. That switch at ovulation, you also release a hormone called relaxin. Relaxin is commonly only really talked about within pregnancy, because it is what allows the pelvis to expand to allow the fetus to come out and meet the world so that it's not as excruciatingly painful. So it actually loosens the ligaments. So ovulation seems to be the peak point that we see the most amount of injuries. Here's the issue, is they go, ovulation is the problem. But then they don't necessarily discuss the fact that within sports and women and those menstruating, that there is a high likelihood of having a delayed ovulation prior to menstruation. It's common to have this, what we would call delayed luteal phase, which can create fertility issues within athletes. Mm. It's more common. And then also polycystic ovarian syndrome is more common within athletes, which then also creates a abnormal or delayed menstrual cycle where you're having 32 day plus versus the traditionally seen normal of 28 days. So going, day 15 is our risk cycle, doesn't really work with athletes. So you have to track their cycles to know where the injury risks are. For my football players, we have found because a lot of them have polycystic ovarian syndrome. They have that delay in ovulation 5 days to 3 days prior to the start of their cycle seems to be the danger zone for ACL, for non-contact ACL ruptures. So it's a question I ask. When we have a knee injury, I go, I know this is going to seem weird. Mm-hmm. What day of the cycle are you at? And that has allowed us to kind of track. And now we're trying to come up with in a different research, which is a little more complicated because the IRB is like, you want to know, we don't want you to do that. I'm like, they're going to play football anyways. Let us see if this helps. I want to look at proprioceptive awareness in knees around the menstrual cycle. There really hasn't been a lot of, so just body awareness of where your joints are in space in relation to ovulation. But that requires a lot of blood draws and hormones and, again, funding required to figure out. And then also, how do we assess proprioception within the knee and knee awareness and get a statistically significant, and then also relate it back to sport? So I'm trying to come up with a design that actually gets through the internal review board of saying it's safe to put on athletes.
Yeah.
And figuring out a method is, could kinesiology tape, which is a known proprioceptive helper, could around ovulation that be a way to prevent non-contact injuries? I don't know. It's a thought.
Yeah. I mean, I would be very interested in that. Because if it's something as simple as that, literally just like a few pieces of tape, and that is what prevents even two or three athletes in a season, you know, not having ACL injuries. I mean, that's huge, right? They have a huge impact.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So before we wrap up here, the other thing that I wanted to just dive into really quickly, if we can, I know it's a big topic, but I also wanted to talk a little bit about the concussion bit, if you are open to that. And what seems to be the difference between concussion susceptibility for female athletes versus male athletes as a whole?
So this is a question that has been plaguing the sports medicine realm of why.
Yeah.
And the things that we're seeing are very similar to the knee. Is it a hormone related? Is it a muscle strength related issue? And some of the things that we're seeing with especially women's sports is they're not actually hitting their head and they're sustaining a concussion like symptom afterwards, because this is going to sound surprising, and this is in the current consensus statement from 2016 within concussions. It doesn't have to be a head injury. It can be a body blow that leads to concussion type symptoms.
Yeah.
And that's super confusing for, if you're not reading concussion and like into concussion, that's like, wait, what? It's not necessarily a head injury. And this is where, when you look at the symptomology of a concussion, so dizzy, woozy, light sound sensitive, headache.
Oh, yeah.
And then you also look at whiplash symptoms, dizzy, woozy, headache, light sound sense. What's the difference? We don't know. And we don't actually have a definitive gold standard for diagnosing concussion, because what is quintessential of a concussion is when taking an MRI, when taking a CT, is having a clean image. So actually doing research and going, this is why women get concussions more often, is really hard because we don't have that gold standard.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, we have the complicating factor of, when we have our hormones, they can make us feel sick. They can cause headaches. They can cause an increase in symptoms that can look like a concussion without having the symptoms. So why women are more predispositioned? One of the things I think revolves around neck strength.
Yes.
Our neck, our head, neck, shoulder ratio is smaller. Our traps aren't as built. as a, yeah. I mean, you look at some of a NFL player and they are no necks. Their shoulders and head are just sitting on top of each other. Okay, well, their head's not going to bobble around. Versus what makes for a feminine aesthetic is having that long neck and having that kind of angle down. Well, that's going to create a bobblehead with this 8-pound pinball on top of you. Right. So are we actually doing any neck strengthening or neck stability work within our women's population, such as chin tucks, where we're like, tucking our chin and creating like a bunch of neck rolls and actually working on those anterior deep neck flexors in controlling our head compared to our men's athletes. And then the other thing is just the fact that, I hate to say it, women's sports are more likely to have red S. So are they performing at a weaker state because they aren't actually feeding their body and performing at the highest level? Like all of those things kind of tie together to create this injury-prone creature that society has gone, but you're pretty.
Yeah. I know. Well, yes. And then the point of that though, is that then you take that injury prone image
and put it on a sports field and, you put and it on go, a sports you're fine. Field.
Yeah. It's not the same. And and this is something that we're actually going to dive into on your podcast, which is just as you referenced that red S, but also this idea of like, if you are under eating and you're under fueling and you are wanting to achieve peak performance, but look a certain way, I would really love to create a conversation around where are our goals there? Are we doing sport because we want to look a certain way? Or are we doing sport because we really want to see what types of barriers we can bust through? Two different, entirely different goals there that really create a problem for female athletes particularly, but it does happen in male athletes as well, but that just wanting to look this way, that then you're under eating potentially, you're under fueling, you are putting your body at a state where it doesn't have the nutrition and the literally the calories coming in order to be able to sustain not just your daily life, but also all of this exercise and stuff that you're doing there too. And you're going to end up with issues there, like, period.
And then this gets even more complicated when we look at the funding for women's sports, because sometimes the sponsor puts an aesthetic to a woman's contract.
Absolutely.
That then prevent them from being able to perform at the highest level. I mean, if you're into women's sports, you watch and hear reports from especially our distance runners. Oh, I lost my contract to such and such company because I gained 5 pounds. And it's like, but I'm performing better now that I gained those 5 pounds, but I now don't look a certain way. And then I remember talking with one of my former collegiate, they played D2 volleyball. And at every practice, their coaches weighed them. And if they had gained too much weight, they would be benched. Like, these are things that happen. And is volleyball a weight-based sport?
No. No.
Like,
no.
It's one of those things that we have created this monster, and now we're trying to fix it.
Yeah.
But we have so much baggage packed around that it's really hard to establish. So my focus when I'm working with an athlete is I go, look, we have our nutritionist here. And if I need to bring in a nutritionist, I will. But I try to stay away, except for talking about protein. Hey, you got to make sure you're getting your protein in. And when researching online how much protein a woman needs, understand you probably need to times it by 2.
Yes.
Because society is like, our body is not designed to put on muscle. Our body is designed to make baby and make your body ready for baby, meaning that we have to exceed our body's baseline protein need to actually build and not bulk, just build strength. We have to exceed that for our muscles to actually heal and perform. Otherwise, our body goes om nom nom on our muscles and our performance dips. So I pretty much focus on making sure you get enough protein when working with athletes, because that's the area that I just see we're not doing. And anytime I see an athlete eating a salad, I go, that's fine. Where's the chicken? Where's the tofu? Where's the other stuff? Like, I get so frustrated when I'm like, oh, I have this. And I mean, I think the scariest situation I've dealt with a girl and athletes and this aesthetic need was my first sideline by myself. It was my first sideline as the provider, and I was working girls volleyball, which I was like, this is easy. The worst I'll deal with is an ankle roll. Well, I didn't account for the fact that it was homecoming that week, and one of the athletes had a known condition and was on medication and opted, because their medication made them bloated, to not take their medication that week because their parents weren't home monitoring them, because their mom was like in the hospital and their dad was overseas in the military, but they were 16. So they were essentially a family member was monitoring, but not closely. And it caused them to go into cardiac arrest on the sideline. They knew that was a risk, because the way they got diagnosed with this condition initially had been because they had gone cardiac arrest the year before. I don't know why. Like, so they had stopped taking their medication because they didn't want to be bloated for homecoming, because they felt the societal pressure that it was a better choice to risk cardiac arrest than look a certain way.
Yeah.
And this was in 2016, 2017, like recent.
Yeah.
We have created a horrific monster.
Yeah, I know. I know. You know, but at the same time, we have a lot to learn from this scenario that we're in. And we also have a lot of room to like move forward from here as well. So part of it is educating ourselves, educating others, as far as what we are seeing. And this is one of the things that we are seeing a lot of, what we talked about today. And there's a lot of room to improve. So in kind of wrapping this up, what would you, well, first off, is there anything else that you wanted to cover that we didn't? And also, are there a few takeaways that you would kind of, you know, send off our listeners with?
Yeah. So one of the biggest takeaways, I think, is if you're going to do sport, get a strength coach.
Yeah.
Not a personal trainer. Personal trainers are generally trained in how to aesthetically make, like, help you lose weight, aesthetically look a certain way. They're not designed for sport performance. You need a certified strength and conditioning specialist, and that's a CSCS. That is the person that is going to be able to take your performance goals and build a program to actually get you there.
Yeah.
And then also, I mean, because sometimes, yes, you need to cut weight in a certain way for a certain sport. That's fine. Work with a strength coach so you don't compromise performance when achieving the necessary changes to your body. And the other thing is if your sport doesn't require a certain weight, throw your scale out the window. Because as you build muscle, your scale's going to change. Yeah. And guess what? Your clothes are going to fit better, even though the number may not reflect what's going on in your body. So focus on how things are fitting, how your body's moving, how you're able to do your activity, and yeet that scale off a cliff.
Yes.
those are my thoughts.
I love it. That's so good. I cannot yeah, I can't, what's the word? What's happening to me today? Stress that enough that it like get that strength and conditioning coach. That's a huge lesson I learned, and myself personally. And it's just one thing that, especially for, I mean, anybody, right? But also just for our athletes that are really trying to perform and push limits, like those, that strength and conditioning is really important. Awesome. Wow. Well, Dr. Melissa, thank you. This was an incredible episode. I'm so grateful that you took the time to be with us today. I did want to also say for your podcast, so we just barely touched on the Red S side of things here on this one. So for the listeners and viewers of this one, there's a part two coming, and that is going to be over on Dr. Melissa's podcast. So I will have that linked in all of those things here on ours. So you can go and find the links in the show notes and grab that for yourself and go over and listen to that one, because that one's coming up next. So thank you again. And that is our episode for today.
Hey, did you know that up to 70% of athletes may be deficient in at least one micronutrient, if not potentially deficient in two or more? Micronutrient deficiencies like vitamin D, iron, calcium, vitamin E, B12, B9 are super common in athletes, and they can lead to things like fatigue. They can lead to injuries and fractures, getting sick a lot and missing practice, to unexplained pain and a lot more. On the flip side though, athletes who corrected nutrient deficiencies saw improvements in VO2 max, vertical jump, grip strength, force, improved delayed onset muscle soreness, and a lot more. That's why I created the Strong to the Finish Line free guide for athletes like you to be able to train and compete symptom-free so that you can have the confidence and the power to perform at your best. Get this guide for free at drkirsten.com/finishstrong.